Okay, today is February 26th, 2014. This is the first interview with Paul Buell. You know, Paul, I never asked how you pronounce your last name.
Did it just right.
Okay. This is a phone interview. Paul's at his home in Madison, and I'm in my office at Steenbach Memorial Library. Paul, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Very good. Paul Buell, alternatively Paul Merlin Buell, to give you my middle name, which is my father's first name. I was born September 27, 1944, in Urbana, Illinois.
Thank you. And Paul, I have a copy of your book and the that you edited, and then your article in it. So some of these straightforward questions I'm not necessarily going to ask because they've been asked and answered in a certain way.
Very good.
But I do want to talk a little bit about your parents. It doesn't, at least in what I'm reading in Radical American Me, I don't see a lot of discussion about your parents.
That would be correct. My mother was born in Eliza, Illinois in 1905, a town so small it was sold, as they say, lock, stock, and barrel for $500, a fact which appeared as a curiosity in Ripley's Believe It or Not a comic strip in the newspapers of the 1940s. She was the granddaughter of an abolitionist named Ezra Fuller, who came from Maine to Missouri in the 1850s and was chased across the border ahead of a mob, supposedly, to Illinois, and he later enlisted in the in the Union Army and marched with Sherman through Georgia and lived to a ripe old age and spent some time in my mother's parents' home, reveling them in stories. His nephew was a drummer boy, more of a collateral relation of my mother, but that tradition was very much alive in my family, which had become Republicans in 1856 and remained ever since, until myself. My father's lineage was German on one side, going back to the lower middle class in Heidelberg, Germany, and the 1850s. His mother's side was from rural Indiana, with the possible collateral relative named Bell Boyd, who was a Confederate spy and bed hopping activist who went on the vaudeville stage after the Civil War, much as Sojourner Truth did, happened to die in the Dells after a performance, I think in the 1880s. A very colorful character, and certainly the most colorful in my family, if she really, according to claims, was in my family. At any rate, whereas my mother's father was a short time a school teacher and later mowed lawns with the big machine for the city of Aledo, and was very poor, as my mother was very poor growing up in the town that they removed to, Aledo, Illinois, small town. My father's father was a failed medical student and set up a little grocery store in Moline, Illinois, where he grew up. And according to a legend, joined the Ku Klux Klan just long enough for Grandma to take his sheet away. Moline is the middle class city between Moline, Davenport, and Rock Island. I recently read a memoir of somebody from Moline, about 20 years younger, and that author notes that the Congregational Church was the evidence of middle-class respectability, and that would be my father's family to the T. Ultimate middle-class respectability, although the husband, my father's father, lost the grocery store, worked as a skill worker in the Rock Island Arsenal, and left the family as soon as the youngest child was 6 years old, and left my grandmother a grass widow, as they say, and went off to work in the war industry in California as a skilled worker. So that's sort of the family lineage wrapped up. I can go a little further by saying my father was a geologist, a geophysicist, whose job for the state of Illinois was to find groundwater supplies for farmers in small towns. In central Illinois, I learned after his death, he was described as Mr. Resistivity because of the method used to locate gravel deposits, which was the surest sign of there being a water supply. And he spent a great deal of time in the field with a machine and a number of locals finding usually the ne'er-do-wells of a small town, putting copper and other stakes into the ground and thus sending electricity through the ground and finding if those gravel pits were there. Sort of like water witchery come true through science. My mother was wished to be a social worker, took a degree in nursing in Chicago in the 1920s, met Jane Addams, and was stirred to go to Manhattan and become a settlement house worker in the 1930s after graduating from University of Iowa, where my father graduated. And as she worked in the Kelly Street settlement house, she realized that if she were going to have a family and children, she would have to accept my father's proposal of marriage and move with him to Champaign, Illinois, where the Illinois State Geological Survey resided. This was very happy for him and very unhappy for her. In later years, she was a registered nurse. She tried to talk about unionization, even though she was a lifelong Republican. She was blacklisted, suffered various kinds of woes, physical and mental, and was unhappy in her situation, as I came to understand it in later years, but determinedly feminist in the 19th century sense of believing there would be no wars if only women could rule the world, but also that the repeal of prohibition had been a terrible idea. That more or less sums up my congregational, lower middle class, civil service worker and nurse status in Champaign.
Thank you, Paul. Did you have any siblings?
Yes, I have a sister, blood sister, who was 4 years older than me. And because parents who gave up on having children and adopted and infrequently had a child have an adopted sister who was also 4 years older than me. And one lives still in Champaign, the evangelical sister, and the other lives in Winnetka and is a retired librarian and a liberal Republican, or perhaps even a quiet supporter of Obama and a liberal Episcopalian.
Not that it matters that much, but is the blood sister, so to speak, is she the evangelical or is it the adult?
No, the other way around.
Okay. All right.
But you might say, and I have thought to myself often when I was writing Abraham Lincoln for Beginners, which is really a book for young people, that Lincoln's milieu in Illinois after his family moved there was not very different from my own. The central part of the state is full of people that came from Indiana and Kentucky, white, conservative, Republican, tending towards evangelical religion, and Lincoln made it through those years by being a successful lawyer, but also by disguising his free thinking. And I suppose I found myself growing up in Champaign as a free thinker, feeling more or less the same way as they used to say in the 19th century, the village atheist.
Thank you for that, Paul. So growing up in Champaign and going to school, were there teachers or cohorts that helped to nurture, even though you said it was sort of closeted free thinking, any
yeah.
teachers or students that helped to nurture?
Well, I only mentioned two or three. In eighth grade, I had an African-American history, U.S. history teacher. And as I look back, I'm astounded at how much effect he had upon me thinking of myself becoming a historian. He had been he was a native Champaign person who had been educated at the Sorbonne and then by a misunderstanding, perhaps, came back to Champaign to take more graduate courses. I never finished a PhD and teach in junior high school, which he did the rest of his career, and did a few brave things in terms of housing integration, but basically remained one of the very, very few African-American teachers of any kind. They're the only one I ever encountered in junior high school or high school, but I was very struck by him, and I'm sure that it had to do with his personality, but also with the abolitionism that I recovered. But I remember he showed a documentary film that was supportive of unionization in the South, and that seemed stunning to me as a young Republican. I couldn't understand it. Secondly, when I was about 15, moved to town, Ralph Kies, same spelling as Kies Avenue in Madison, whose father had worked in the Henry Wallace campaign in 1948 and was blacklisted, essentially, was a city planner in Puerto Rico for 15 years, and then managed to get this job at University of Illinois. Ralph's father was a hard-bitten Quaker, and his mother was a disciple of Kropotkin, but they both were Adlai Stevenson devotees. So Ralph was half Jewish, half Quaker, and in their household, we watched Viva Zapata when it came on the television. We had discussions about civil rights and peace and so forth that I could not have had in the home of any other fellow student. And that was pretty extraordinary, and a way for me to grow into things. I remember when the Hands Off Cuba ad appeared in the daily newspaper, I signed it immediately and gave them my friend Ralph's phone number, and they called me at his house, which was sort of discomforting for his mother, understandably. But I was part of a very hidden left-wing milieu within Champaign, and I suppose you could also say within the Democratic Party, which was very small in Champaign-Urbana and limited to university people, more or less. And a third, a saxophone-playing African-American who was an intellectual, a very interesting guy, a year older than me. He has been a gay doctor in Harlem for almost 40 years and was the person for whom I would drive into the ghetto in Champaign, something I hadn't done otherwise, though I surely would do so again when the civil rights movement briefly came to town and I would drive to meetings. But rarely would white people drive into the ghetto, and at that point it was one of the most segregated cities in Illinois, so that rarely would non-whites be in the 90% of town except as servants and service workers.
Paul, thank you for that. So I grew up with, they still are, very Republican parents, and I always sort of felt myself that I was Republican just because of them until I realized, I wasn't. did you have any sort of epiphany like that?
I think my revelatory events, even knowing one always recasts these things in memory, may have been seeing about the civil rights events on television, but also in the drugstore, local drugstore, where I would go to the paperback rack and pick up new science fiction books of every good and terrible kind, wonderful ones like The Space Merchants, which was very caustic and written by people who'd been close to the Young Communist League in their youth in New York, but also some nonfiction books. And the two nonfiction books that stood out were Why We Can't Wait by Martin Luther King Jr. and Listen Yankee by C. Wright Mills. And I can remember the days I bought those books because I took them home and they became my Bible, so to speak. They were very, very significant to me, opened my eyes, so forth and so forth. Because the civil rights movement came to town in 1960, and I spontaneously joined a picket line, not knowing anything about it, in a dull summer afternoon, but walking downtown and seeing this picket line, certainly the most exciting day in my life since I had thrown a no-hitter in Little League. Those would be two peak days in my youth and young life. Enrolled myself in it energetically. It didn't last too long. And in truth, because there were no Democrats in town to speak of, because elections were a certain principle, Republicans would be elected as they were in Champaign County every year in the 20th century, except for 1936 and 1976, I think, because of the Nixon debacle. At any rate, I don't think it occurred to me that there was some meaningful alternative to the Republican Party that I could join and be part of. So that even being a quote-unquote liberal hardly crossed my brow. We can get into this in a little bit later, but when I became a socialist at age 18, I seem to have gone from being a naive Republican to a beatnik cynic into being a socialist without much in between.
Thank you again for that, Paul. There's one thing I want to just touch on, and again, it comes from the piece that you wrote in the book that you edited.
Uh-huh.
And it says, within a year, I saw In Madrid, by pure chance. So you were in Spain at some point growing up?
Yes, only for a few days. In the summer of 1960, my parents went on one of those $10 a day tours to Europe. We drove, that is to say, my father drove all the way from the UK to Spain. And it was sort of eye-opening the way it would be for an ordinary American teenager in the 1960s, exotic and different and so forth and so forth. But while we were in Madrid, I saw a man racing down the street, pursued by these political police, as I came to know what they were. They had a very particular helmet. Then I saw people leaning over with clubs and beating this person, and then I saw a body covered, entirely covered, and soaked in with sheets soaked in blood. And I don't think that my mother and father and my one sister, they didn't know what to make of it. You know, it was just so far outside their experience. It was like some American exotic thing that you'd see that didn't make any sense, and so it didn't leave such a big lasting impression on you. But it left a very distinct impression on me, presuming that I was ready for it. I've been reading about Francisco Franco or something or other. I couldn't cast it in the light of anything left, right, or anything like that, but I guess I had a feeling for what fascism was.
Thank you. So again, in this piece, you talk about going to, I'm guessing, Champaign for undergraduate. Why did you choose?
I need to probably to mention one more thing.
Okay.
Along the way, which is the Congregational Church was so locked into university life that it closed in the summer, and consequently, there was no youth group. So I looked for another youth group, was sort of the only social outlet in Champaign. And a friend or someone I admired was part of the University Place Christian Church, which happened to be, though I didn't know it, the Disciples of Christ, a southern-based denomination, predominantly conservative because of its southern location, but sort of just bland in Champaign-Urbana among the other churches, but they had a very active youth group. They had, above all things, a pool table. And I joined the Christian Youth Fellowship, CYF. It was a wonderful opportunity for me to evangelize about civil rights. And the leaders of this group, the two youth leaders, who were a husband and wife in their 30s, sort of encouraged anything. I couldn't tell if they were sympathetic, but they thought it was good that somebody was idealistic. So they made me an officer of some kind. I still don't know what kind of officer I was. And on the basis of being an officer, I was appointed to the newly created Champaign-Urbana Youth Council, which was made up, I think, of church representatives. And we met several times in the fall of 1962, and I realized that it was a do-gooders group which intended to do nothing whatsoever about the crushing burden of racism. And it's further alienated me. I have to go back and say that there had been a race riot in the public park very close to our high school, and I had stood in the middle of the park and said, "Brothers, your enemy is elsewhere," or something like that, and somebody picked up a brick bat and was going to hit me. And then happily the police came. But I was looked upon mostly in a hostile way as a civil rights evangelist of sorts, of a non-religious sort. And I was happy to claim that identity. Maybe it was better than any other identity that I had. But after this experience with the youth council, or for other reasons, I just wanted to get out of high school. And so I graduated early in January of 1963 and came to the university. And in as much as I graduated in January, I didn't really have any choice about where to go to school, nor did I have any idea. One other footnote, and when I was teaching at Brown, I was to meet as a freshman advisor several freshmen from Champaign-Urbana, and every single one of them had gone to University High School, which was the prep school in town. You had to make a decision when you were 12 years old to go there, and it was, if not predominantly Jewish, at least took away every Jewish kid I knew at age 11. They all disappeared and went to University High School. Why I didn't go, I'm puzzled to this day. I don't know. I was afraid of leaving my common milieu, although I probably would have been better if I had. At any rate, those kids, they went off to the Ivy League, whereas Champaign High, Urbana High was almost like Uni High. It was full of professors' children, or had a lot of them. Champaign High was lower middle class, and the teaching level wasn't very good, and it was a very natural thing to go to the U of I. In my case, actually saving money to live at home and go to the U of I. So I was still going to classes, but they were now across town.
Okay. Thank you for that. So one more thing about the transition. It sounds like you graduated early. As you were making that transition from high school to college, did you have an idea of what you wanted to major in or what you wanted to be?
I had the idea. I'd already been drinking as much beer as I could get my hands on, and I had the idea that being a high school teacher was a great thing because you could spend the summer drinking beer. Where otherwise I got the idea of being a history teacher, I feel sure came from this African-American teacher of eighth grade.
Okay. So one thing, one of those touchstone moments of American history, so it's around this time, if we're, you know, as we're sort of going chronologically here in 1963, that President Kennedy was assassinated. I'm wondering if you could speak to your memories
indeed,
of that event.
Indeed. A little more fill-in here. In the summer of 1963, and now I've got my chronology wrong because I actually began college in January of 1962. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
In the summer of 1963, a young beatnik girl who I'd met in the folk song club of University of Illinois, sort of a center for dissenting everything. It included people who took marijuana and the available other drugs, sort of beatnik women from New York who wore leotards, and very much closeted gay and lesbians, and so forth. So it was that sort of cultural milieu in a big fraternity sorority campus. Anyway, this young woman and I left Champaign on a bus for San Francisco, thinking that we would have a big cultural experience, and we did. We went on living together, and we've been married for 50 years. At any rate, in the summer of 1963, I found a socialist newspaper, the only socialist newspaper that could be found in San Francisco, and by September joined the Socialist Labor Party, a small, largely blue-collar group that had been in existence since the 1890s and held what were called impossibilist positions. That is to say, nothing was worthwhile doing except getting rid of capitalism. It was a very interesting group because it believed in the disintegration of the state, the dissolution of the state, and its replacement by workers' councils, which were entirely functional and not political in the normal sense of political. It was a remnant of the era of the industrial workers of the world, and only in a time when there was so little ability, opportunity, to plug into things would I have been part of it. But it was an intellectual experience valuable to me. Meanwhile, things were heating up politically in the early free speech movement across the Bay, but it didn't really reach so much into San Francisco until about the time we were leaving in December of 1963. And in the meantime, I went to San Francisco State, and the very day that Kennedy was assassinated, I had a large handful of socialist leaflets I was going to pass out on campus. But my roommate, soon to be my wife, Mary Jo, said, "This is not a good day for handing out socialist leaflets." And I thought about it for a bit, and I thought, yeah, that's probably right. So it was shocking. People were crying on campus. It might be remembered, San Francisco State had many, many returnee students who were working at various jobs in San Francisco, and it was far more left-wing, as San Francisco was far more left-wing than the normal student population, and much less Catholic than many schools where the death of Kennedy was a huge trauma as the first Catholic president. But there was enormous anxiety, even in liberal San Francisco, about this change, and also just people wondering what in the world was going to happen now.
So you and Mary Jo decided to return to Champaign?
We had no choice. The opportunity to get into Berkeley, it was almost impossible if you were from out of state, and also very expensive. So very reluctantly, we returned to University of Illinois.
So once back, were you still thinking of education or high school teacher as a...
Here I got puzzled, and I was thinking of myself as a professional revolutionary, a very strange notion which appeared and disappeared in the 1960s and 1970s, but of course had a long and honorable tradition in the later 19th century and early 20th century. So that I was reading everything I could get my hands on, thinking about how I could get to New York and how someday there would be a new socialist movement and I could work in or even direct an academy of socialists in the true European fashion. I wanted to educate, to be an educator, but I didn't have any idea of how I could be an educator and being in public school, or private school for that matter, in a normal college or university was something that was disappearing from my mind. Meanwhile, the draft, the war was picking up, the Vietnam War was picking up by 1965, and it was clear that people like myself were highly subject to the draft. So that when Mary Jo and I graduated in January of 1966, we had already made plans for me to continue my education by going to graduate school in pretty much the first place that asked me to accepted me for graduate study, and that was University of Connecticut in Storrs.
Okay. So I asked a question about possible teachers of note or cohorts of note in... in high school,
yes,
what about in college?
To ask. Yes, there were a number of interesting professors, but doubtless the one who connected me to go to University of Connecticut and really, in the long run, directed me to come to University of Wisconsin was a guy named Rudolf Vacoli, who would become the founder of the Center for Immigration History at Minneapolis-St. Paul, a real important institution for the history of the especially European immigrant working class coming to the U.S. He was a young history teacher then at University of Illinois before he went to Minnesota and did that. And then he also also sent me to another UW graduate who was a Finnish American with communist parents in the University of Connecticut, A. William Hoagland, quietly gay, quietly left-leaning character, who was a real scholar of immigration as well. They both had been students of Curdy, which is an interesting connection for my life. But there were other, very few other professors who were anti-war. I didn't even necessarily have them as professors, but they sponsored anti-war activities, and one of them sponsored the Students for Democratic Society chapter. And that I joined as soon as I found out it existed on campus in September 1965. I had gone to the SDS-led or SDS-called demonstration against the war in April 1965 in Washington, because suddenly a place appeared on the private plane or chartered plane that went from Champaign to D.C. in April 1965. A big thrill for me, and probably due to the same professor. I mention her without being able to remember her name, because she had been a young Communist League a colonizer of Gary steel mills in 1950, as a few thousand other young communists were, and then dropped out of that activity and went back to school, got a PhD, became a professor, and sort of conveniently put that past away because it was dangerous to her career, but had strong left-wing sentiments. And was part of a very small and mostly hidden group of professors who would never reveal themselves in Champaign as having any kind of Marxist affiliations, but were encouraging when some young person would affiliate with them, show an interest. And when the SDS chapter reformed, I found myself almost immediately the spokesperson, notably at the October 21st, the first fall campus demonstrations against the Vietnam War. When I say spokesperson, I mean MC at the rally, the person that spoke on local education television, WILL, and appeared to do these public things very surprisingly to myself then, and for some years later, until a former fellow SDS member in Champaign-Urbana reminded me that almost the entire chapter was Jewish and from Chicago, and they were very eager to have a Gentile from downstate be their face to the crowd.
Right.
I believe I paid them back by learning Yiddish and becoming a scholar of the Jewish left, but we'll get to that on another day.
Right. There's a question I want to ask. It's not on the list, but you mentioned the idea of meeting people who were gay or lesbian.
Uh-huh.
The world's changed a lot in 50 years, and really has changed a lot just recently.
Yep.
Would these people come out to you as gay and lesbian?
To me. Very, very hesitantly. It was more as if one would be at parties and somebody would say something, you know, or like a woman 3 or 4 years older, that is to say, could buy alcohol, who was from Mary Jo's hometown of North Chicago, Illinois. That's just next to Waukegan across the border, one of those industrial towns that lost its industry in the last 30 years. And she was a dynamic, magnetic personality for 3 or 4 young men, including me, but sexually unavailable or unattainable, and quote-unquote spent the summer in Greenwich Village. And it later became clear that she was, you know, quietly in the closet, and whether she was sexually active or not, that I don't know. And likewise, in the folk song group and club, I don't think it's that there was anything physically or in terms of behavior identifiable. People were pretty cautious about that, and yet stories would sort of come out, and you know, it was they were affable, progressive, but it didn't appear as if there would ever be any kind of breakthrough. It was as if there was this very, very special university milieu in which all kinds of things could be hidden, and most of the things that could be hidden happened in the same milieu, which put it very much under the watchful eye of the local FBI, as we were to find out.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the chapter you wrote for your book, the idea that the chief of security was also the FBI. It sounds like that's something you found out, that connection later?
Not greatly later, because his personality, him as a figure, that was known on campus. And when we would sit in bars and an older man with a trench coat would be at the next table, it wasn't very hard to figure out this is what they had in mind. But what I learned, I think at the time or shortly after, was that my sister, who's in Champaign and is an evangelical, she and her husband were part of the Civil Air Patrol, which is sort of a social group of a kind who were liked airplanes. Another member of the group was a local FBI agent, not the top agent on campus, but it was normal to have an FBI agent, just like another hobby of a military-minded person. And my sister had broached the subject of my being in the Socialist Labor Party. So I think a small investigation opened when I was 19. And then I became a spokesman for SDS on campus, and things sort of grew after that.
Okay. You said you went to Connecticut, you and Mary Jo went to Connecticut specifically to, you know, try to get into graduate school as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
And I think you allude to this in the book, or you might say it directly, but how does the transition then go between Storrs, Connecticut, and Madison, Wisconsin?
Well, Storrs was very beautiful place in those days, but it was very much of a lower middle class commuter campus, and consequently very, very difficult to organize politically. I was the leader of a very weak SDS chapter. We were able to have an occasional lecturer to come in, and dozens of people would come and hear that lecturer and pass out leaflets at various times. But it really wasn't very much, and it probably was the weakness of the SDS chapter that prompted me to try to have some other useful role in a relationship to SDS at large. And that, more than anything else, caused me to have the idea of starting this magazine to educate SDSers fundamentally, because the Radical Education Project set up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, had as its aim to reach these undergraduates who were in the SDS milieu in dozens of chapters, finally hundreds, and give them some kind of basis of knowledge in politics. My chosen area was the history of the American left. I had written an honors thesis on Daniel DeLeon, who had been a great figure in the Socialist Labor Party way back before he died in 1914, and had a developing interest in other kinds of things related to the history of the left. And then I should add, for a summer of 1966, Mary Jo and I lived in New York City because I worked at the National Guardian, which was then a solid left-wing weekly newspaper that had been very close to the milieu around Henry Wallace, the Progressive Party candidate of 1948, and was very good on civil rights, very good against the war, and was quietly supportive of, if not really the Soviet Union, or at least the idea that the Cold War was a bad idea. The most attractive opposition paper. All I did was to collect ads and do other kinds of menial tasks in that summer of 66. But we lived there, and I took a class at what was called the Free University of New York with James Weinstein, the foremost historian of American socialism, who had founded, no, been part of the founding and editing of the journal Studies in the Left. Okay, by 1966, Studies in the Left folded. It had moved from Madison to New York and then hit some kind of political obstacle that couldn't go ahead. And therefore, there was a vacuum of some kind. And on that basis, and with almost no money and with the most primitive mechanical means, I managed to publish one issue of Radical America in Storrs, circulated mainly through contacts in SDS through the Radical Education Project. And by the time I came to Madison, an SDS activist and the creator of pamphlets from the SDS chapter on various subjects, a really wonderful organizer, Jim O'Brien, had already volunteered over the summer in correspondence to join with me, to encourage me to publish Radical America in Madison on a better, more solid basis, and it was to be printed one page at a time by Henry Hoslock, who was not only a longtime math graduate student teacher, but also the head of SDS and the leading figure in the negotiations over founding a teaching assistance association. So by sleeping at Henry Hoslock's the first couple nights in August 1967, before we found an apartment on Spade Street on the east side, we had sort of met everybody. And walking from Henry Hoslock's house, now a vanished area next to the railroad tracks, to the campus, passing a softball game that included a dozen left-wing personalities, including Evan Stark. I remember them shouting, come and join us. And I said, I don't have time, I'm a Marxist. And I think it was either Evan Stark or Bob Cohen who shouted back at me, we have all the Marxists we need already, what we need is a second baseman. there I was plunged into something which I recognized as the Midwest that I'd always wanted to be in, not Champaign, or not Bloomington, not Columbus, Ohio, but Madison, or I suppose Ann Arbor or Minneapolis might have been in the same category, but a Midwest that was felt like home to me, but the home I hadn't had, and had a radical tradition of its own, and plenty of vibrant intellectual life, and left-wing people didn't have to disguise themselves as they had in Champaign-Urbana.
Thank you, Paul. Before I forget, I don't think this is actually on our list. I wonder if you could speak to the physical nature of publishing, whether it was the issue in stores or the issues in Madison, because publishing obviously is completely different in 2014 indeed than it was then.
I'm trying to remember how the first issue was even published. Probably at a Xerox shop if they existed in 1966, but I'm not certain they did. If not, it may have been mimeographed. At any rate, as soon as it got to Madison, and stapled with individual staples as if it were a pamphlet and not a magazine. When we got to Madison, Jim O'Brien and Hank Hoslock introduced me to the saddle stitch stapler, which is to say pages would be printed on both sides, 8.5 by 11. They would be collated, put onto this saddle stitch so that they could be stapled on the edge, so that they look three staples. So they look sort of magazine-like, and then put into mailing envelopes to send to SDS chapters or to individuals, and taken to the post office. There was one on University Avenue, now where the Chazen is now, and another post office on Winnebago. And one place or the other, I would load up everything in my VW and make a couple of trips and send them all out. But I've forgotten about a stage. There was a kind of green semi-plastic covering to a newspaper. We would type out the finished article on those, correct it with some kind of green correcto material, and then that's what Henry Hoslock used to create a photographic, reversal photographic image, and then print it. So it was more cumbersome than one could imagine, but on the other hand, the entire thing was incredibly cheap, and postal rates were, by even the standards of the mid-70s, unbelievably low. And if Radical America lost money with virtually every issue. It didn't lose very much money.
Thank you. So you said you and Mary Jo found an apartment on Spate Street, right?
Right, that's correct.
Sometimes we get Spate and State. I wanted to make sure that we really hit
well,
that key.
Well, this is of great moment to me because I'm working with the mayor on his memoirs, and so I'm recalling or drafting recollections of the East Side as the old industrial center where Gishel Tool had not yet closed down. It was in the process of closing down, where the blue-collar working class had not yet moved out, which is to say moved west along Atwood out to Monona, and where the two-family houses that are basically the neighborhood, much of the neighborhood, were not yet occupied by graduate students, and where, to put the point a little more strongly, the city administrations until 1968 had been inclined to take urban renewal or urban removal funds to essentially make the East Side into a sacrifice zone and run a highway over the last two blocks of Williamson, with the idea that nothing could happen in the East Side because now, with industry gone, it was just going to collapse more or less. Thanks to Paul Soglin and a number of others, none of those plans took place. And meanwhile, the very year that I moved there, dozens of other graduate students moved within just a few blocks of me. The apartments were $75 a month plus heat. And a very, very accommodating in many ways. The bars changed over their populations very quickly and very successfully. And the neighborhood revived in a remarkable new fashion. Even by the time we left in 1971, it was very largely transformed. And it was certainly the center of the meetings of the Teaching Assistants Association and a wide variety of left-wing and cooperative movements.
So it sounds like you not only found a place that you considered to be home, a neighborhood sort of built around you and others. So September 1967, the next month, is the Dow riot, which is...
Or the Dow police riot, as we like to call it.
The Dow police riot. I wonder if you could... I know you've talked about this in other places, but I wonder if you could speak
to
your memory.
Well, I'll make it brief because I have talked about other places. Mary Jo was working on the History of Wisconsin series at the Historical Society from the first day we got to campus. She got that job and retained it even when she was a teaching assistant for, I think, a year and a half. I was just going to graduate school, and when the plans were announced for the sit-in, I didn't have even a second thought about going. I just automatically went without thinking about it. But I feel sure, and Paul Soglin says as well, that we really did not expect the police to come in and bash us. We thought simply being there was, you know, what we were making witness in the almost Quakerish sense. And we were stunned by the level of violence of the police. Contrary to everything David Marinus has written in his account, they were overwhelmingly hostile, slugging women as well as men with their clubs, and they were deeply influenced by and directed by Chief Inspector Herman Thomas, who, as everybody knew, although Marinus would never say so, had Birch Society materials in his outer office and regarded SDS and the student movement as a whole as dangerous revolutionaries as any Birch Society sympathizer would. His police department, all white and all male, was very hostile toward non-whites, of course, toward Jews from New York, who were regarded as the source of all the problems on campus, very pro-war. But also, as became clear within a year or so, very, very eager to get the overtime that came with supposedly keeping the students at bay and sending in infiltrators to do all kinds of things not long after to be forth and so forth, because overtime was great. And I know this from many places, but mainly from the former chief of the fire department, earlier chief of the Firemen's Union, Firefighters Union, who watched all of it up close and testified to the level of moral corruption in the police force. But you could say financial corruption, too, because riots are good for them. So I didn't learn about this stuff until much later, but I could tell that a decisive moment, a decisive change had taken place on campus, and as the issue of Connections, the underground newspaper, appeared shortly after, and it was just great. It was fabulously informative in ways that even the Capital Times was not whatsoever in relation to the war or the campus scene. I probably took 50 copies into the dorms and gave speeches in the dorms and sat with students and so forth, but mostly marveled at how students had taken things on themselves, undergraduates mainly, also graduate students, in creating their own classes, and then as as classes returned, were more serious about the meaning of history than I'd ever known them to be, and truth that I've ever known them to be again. It was a marvelous, engaged student population of young people who thought young people could change the world, and that they had to because they, the male ones, were being drafted to go to this monstrous war.
Thank you for that, Paul. I think you mentioned this in your article, but did you know the people who were in charge of Connections?
I must have met them very, very shortly, because we did the printing of Radical America was in the back room of the Connections office. That's exactly how I knew them.
Okay.
The one sheet printing press. But Robert Gabriner was, a great presence on campus, and I remember going to a party at his house. He was the central figure in Connections. And his poetry editor was a fellow named Dave Wagner, whose wife worked on the History of Wisconsin series with Mary Jo, that is Grace Wagner. And Dave Wagner and I became instant, really good friends, and remained so ever since. He taught me about poetry, and I taught him about Marxism, so we probably were equal to each other. So I was meeting people and understanding what organizing is very, very quickly in the fall of 1967, and immensely appreciative of the opportunity to do so.
Paul, I want to shift gears slightly, although I think it relates. You talk about students being engaged and your history classes being as rich as they ever were or ever would be. But specifically, when you came here, who did you come here to study under, or did you
know?
Well,
there's the problem. Professor A. William Hoagland, as Mary Jo and I were completing our MAs, said to us, "Now it's time for you to go home." Home always meant at UW and Madison. So we did. Would we have thought of it otherwise? Maybe not so clearly, but everyone was accepted. There was no difficulty getting into school. I didn't have a TA the first semester. No, I had an RA. That is to say, I worked in the Historical Society archives, processing the papers of a union, which was just great. Wonderful meeting the people in there and learning more about how to process archival material, et cetera, et cetera. What we thought of as the great professors, with one exception, had already fled, which is to say retired. Curdy and a handful of others, they were no longer professors, although they mostly stayed in town. But the one exception was William Appleman Williams. Now, and I was able to take one course with him before he departed, but that made an immense impression on me, as he did on everybody else. I really was talking about U.S. history, because European history meant George Mossy and Harvey Goldberg. I didn't actually take a class from Goldberg, but I met with them off and on. George Mossy had as much impact on me as on thousands of other people. At any rate, I was in a seminar led by Paul Glad, who was a sort of milk and water liberal, an okay fellow. But in the seminar was Frank Emspach and a number of other people who I would know most of the rest of my life. So that this is the important point, and I'm sorry I didn't get to it directly. Our association, collectively speaking, with professors, especially in the American side, was rather weak. But our presence as graduate students in an enormous graduate student class, the largest it would ever be at UW, was intense and rich. Instead of competing with each other, as I suppose graduate students are expected to be, we were a very large, very rich, very left-leaning community. So that within that community, we had all the resources that we wanted. And if we picketed buildings and had little respect for professors who crossed the picket lines, in general, and there weren't too many in history at any rate, in general, we were a world of graduate students unto ourselves.
Okay, so just to make sure I'm hearing you right, so it's really your cohort, your graduate students were really the more than the professors, the graduate students were.
One more with Williams, the exception, U.S. history, Mossy and Goldberg, the exception. And there were some other outstanding professors, but I just was focused on mainly on U.S. history and working on my chosen subject and engaged in publishing a magazine and all those picket lines and TAA meetings and all the other things that were going on.
So what did you choose to... well, first off, I think I read that you came here with an MA. Is that correct?
I came with an MA. My MA was on Louis C. Freina, F-R-A-I-N-A, / Louis Corey, the name he later took. He was the most avant-garde character in the Socialist Party milieu of Social Labor Party milieu of Daniel DeLand to cross over into the proto-communist left of the later 1910s. He'd also edited Modern Dance magazine and was a working-class Italian-American who was sui generis in many ways and rushed to the Soviet Union in the early 20s. And then various bad things happened to him, and he reemerged as Louis Corey in the 30s, a prominent economist, but he was on his way to being a fanatical anti-communist. And in many ways, the huge promise of his youth ending up being disappointing to himself and everyone else was the story of the decline of the American left from its pre-1920 status, which remains my sentimental favorite, to the deadness of the 1950s that I grew up in, with interesting things happening in many stages in between. But with that sense of decline as a melancholy note in the MA thesis that I wrote. But my intent had always been to have something broader and to write the history of Marxism in the United States. And that was what I was thinking about from the first moment I got to campus in 1967.
So I should know this, but how did the Marxism in the U.S., how did that then turn into the dissertation?
Well, as I said, a very, very good question, but a complex question. Mary Jo Buell wrote a dissertation more or less about women in American socialism, and then looking at it with an eye to writing a monograph, started over again. Not with the research, but because the dissertation form was displeasing or just not what we had in mind. Much the same with me. I completed the dissertation in 1975, but at that time, many U.S. historians were realizing the limitations of the English language, and I was realizing, although late to realize, that most of the members of the socialist and communist parties had been immigrants, European immigrants, and that most of the newspapers published for those parties had been published in non-English languages. Now, there were real limitations. I was never going to learn Finnish or Hungarian or Russian. But I could take a dive at German. I had been a C student in high school and college, never outstanding. And from German, I could migrate toward Yiddish, which is high middle German written in a Hebrew script or Aramaic script and reading right to left. And as a youngish social historian, the idea of discovering these new things and reading newspapers that nobody had read for 60 years seemed very exciting. And so that's how I concluded my time with my dissertation, thinking this just isn't good enough even as I do it, and then moved on to a wider sense, which, darn it, took me another 10 years to work on. But out of which all of the excess knowledge that I acquired in the meantime by founding the Oral History of the American Left in 1976 at New York University, out of that came the Encyclopedia of the American Left, published in 1990, which is sort of like the grand version of my dissertation, only it's 1,000 pages and has 60 authors.
Paul, thank you for that. I think for a couple reasons, this may be a good point to wrap up for the day.
Good.
I want to thank you for your time. I want to chat briefly after I turn off the recorder.
Very good.
Paul, thank you for your time today, and this concludes the first oral history interview with Paul Buell.